LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hey, folks. Welcome to Labor Relations Information Systems' First Thursday podcast for August 2014. My name is Will Acheson, and I'll be spending the next 45 minutes or so with you going over recent developments in public safety labor relations. Last month when I did this podcast, I focused an awful lot on, in particular, three U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and did so kind of at the expense of some other things that have been going on out there. This month, I want to do a little bit more of a potpourri, and what better place to start than with contract settlement trends. I've mentioned over the course of several podcasts that 2014 is shaping up to be a very different year in terms of law enforcement, fire protection, collective bargaining agreements. Very different even from 2013 and even from late 2013. Over the course of the last few years, we've seen a whole bunch of wage freezes in various jurisdictions. We've also seen benefit cuts, and largely all of that has changed in 2014. Almost everybody who is settling a contract is getting a raise, and the raise seems to be in the range of 2-3%. And the benefit cuts, even though you still see them, they're not the dominant theme that they were, and they're not nearly as serious as they were even last year. So let me take you on a little bit of a tour around the country, give you some context where it's appropriate, and talk about settlements in big city fire and police departments and some sheriff's offices. And let's start with Fort Wayne, Indiana, the fire department in Fort Wayne. To understand this, though, you've got to understand that Indiana does not have a statewide collective bargaining law. Instead, cities make the individual choice in Indiana as to whether they're going to bargain. Fort Wayne has a rich history, I might say had a rich history, of collective bargaining for its public employees. But then a while back, I want to say about a year and a half ago or so, the Fort Wayne City Council was taken over by what some people have called the Tea Party movement. And one of the agendas of the folks who've taken over the city council has been to either eliminate or significantly reduce collective bargaining. One of the first things that the city council did was to flatly end collective bargaining for everybody but police and firefighters. This settlement shows you the continued trend of that, although it's not that the city council ended bargaining for the firefighters. In fact, they approved a two-year contract, that calls for 2% raises annually. But during the same meeting where the council approved that contract, it voted to implement a right-to-work law with respect to police and firefighters, meaning members of the bargaining units for police and fire no longer have to be either members of the labor organizations or pay their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the contract. So the Fort Wayne settlement was sort of a push and pull. There was good and bad news in it for the firefighters. St. Paul, Minnesota, just north of Fort Wayne, we see for the police department a three-year contract that is produced as the result of binding arbitration. It'll have two raises in it, 3.5% that's retroactive to 2013, and 2.75% that'll be implemented in 2014. So a pretty decent raise, looks like 6.25% over the 3 years of the contract. That's the management proposal in that arbitration. Police Officers Association, not terribly happy with that proposal, but it still is a raise. Let's move to the east, and we'll go to Summit County, the sheriff's office in Summit County. Here we had Ohio has a law, a collective bargaining law. It's a little bit different than most. It does call for binding arbitration. In Ohio, they call it binding conciliation, but it's the same thing. But there is a earlier step in the process that's mandatory called fact-finding. Fact-finders are arbitrators, essentially, and they come in, and rather than make binding decisions, what they do is to recommend a settlement. And if either side rejects the fact finder's recommendations, then you go on to binding arbitration. Well, here, both sides accepted the fact finder's recommendations. And what were they? A 2014 raise of 1.5%, a 2015 raise of 2%, and a 2016 raise of 2.25%. So once again, those raises in the range of 2 to 3%. The next settlement comes out of Syracuse, New York. This is one of the hard-hit cities in New York by the economic downturn. In fact, Syracuse's money woes preceded the economic downturn by a number of years. This is a contract settlement for police officers there, and it runs from 2011 through 2015. In 2011 and 2012, no money, no increases in wages. 2013, 14, and 15, 2% each year. There will be some increased payments for health insurance. The copayment on premiums will increase from $60 to $130 a month for full family coverage. And eventually, we'll go up to $200 a month. But people in Syracuse, the rank and file members of the police department there, will be seeing their first raise in many, many years. Not so in Vallejo, California. Vallejo, of course, the poster child for municipal bankruptcy, actually successfully went through the bankruptcy process, but that hasn't solved all of the problems. And the city of Vallejo, which is just outside of San Francisco, it's part of the Bay Area, city of Vallejo just unilaterally imposed a 6-month contract. California, most jurisdictions don't have binding arbitration, and the employer can unilaterally impose its last best offer, and so the city did. And these are employees, these were police that were imposed upon, but firefighters had the same thing. These are employees who've had huge cuts in wages and benefits over the course of the last 6-7 years. More cuts as a result of this imposed contract. 5% reduction in pay effective January 1, 2014, and also insurance benefit cuts. And when I say there's a general trend out there for 2 to 3% wage increase, it doesn't mean there aren't exceptions. There are jurisdictions that are still very hard hit, and Vallejo is one of them. Let's go over to Washington, D.C., where we have a couple of arbitrated decisions, one for the fire department, one for the police department. The firefighters were in catch-up mode, catch-up in terms of they were trying to go back a number of years. They were trying to go back all the way to 2008. And they ended up with a contract that called for no wage increase for 08, 09, 2010, and 2011. They'll get 3% in 2012, 3.5% in 2013, and 3.5% in 2014. It's the first raise for firefighters in Washington, D.C. since 2006. You probably know that the city of Washington, D.C. is strongly dependent upon federal oversight, federal funding, and so the budget for the city of Washington, D.C. has been hung up for many, many years in the political infighting in Congress. The police arbitration decision calls for a 4% increase retro to 2013, no increase in 2014, and then 3% increases in 15, 16, and 17. So at least by my count, those are raises that average somewhere around 3.3% over the 4 years that this contract will cover. An interesting side issue here. You may be aware that the labor organization representing Washington, D.C. police, which is the FOP, and the Washington, D.C. police chief have been locked in almost mortal combat for a number of years. I think on a per capita basis, more lawsuits, more grievances, more everything in Washington, D.C. police department than in really any other police department I know of in the country. One of the proposals that the district went to arbitration on was a proposal to limit arbitrators' authorities over the discipline of police officers. That is a proposal. You see those proposals go to arbitration from time to time. They have kind of predictable results, right? Can you imagine trying to convince your arbitrator that it's not a good idea to have arbitrators hear disciplinary cases? That's a really tough road to hoe. And as you might expect, the city lost that. The arbitrator decided there should be no changes in the arbitration process over discipline. That's a pretty good roundup. There's lots of other settlements out there, of course, but you kind of are getting, if you look through these settlements, and by the way, we detail many more of them in our print publication, Public Safety Labor News, that comes out every month. You kind of get a feel for all of these settlements that things are turning around economically, that the effects of the recession are finally dissipating, at least a bit, in the public safety labor environment. Let's now go over to a very important decision coming out of Connecticut. It's a low-level sort of case. It's coming out of a state labor board, so it's not like it's coming out of a court or Supreme Court or anything like that. But it deals with a question that pops up from time to time about which there's a bit of debate in the community. Most of the cases go the same way, but there still seems to be a debate in the labor community over this. And the question is, do Weingarten rights apply to written statements? So just to back up, Weingarten rights, this is the right to be represented by a labor organization in a disciplinary interview. And the way you commonly see Weingarten phrased is, if an employee has a reasonable belief that discipline could result from a interview or from questioning by the employer, then the employee has the right to representation during that questioning. Well, here's what goes on in this case out of Connecticut. It comes out of the city of New Haven, Connecticut, and the fire department there. And this is a situation that you occasionally see where you have a president of a union, in this case it's a fellow named Patrick Egan, who was the president of Local 825 of the IAFF, a president of a union promoted to a chief's position, and very quickly there are huge tensions between the union and the newly promoted chief. And so it was in New Haven. When Egan was promoted, he was succeeded as president of Local 825 by a fellow named James Cottage, and very quickly relations became quite strained. And one of the issues over which relations became strained was that Egan, now Assistant Chief Egan, took the position that when members sent materials to the chief's office, whatever they might be, they should not send a copy of those materials to Local 825. The union, of course, Cottage, the new president, had grief over that, but nothing got filed until there was a case involving another lieutenant, a Lieutenant Gary Cole. Cole was being investigated for possibly inappropriate off-duty post on Facebook. He was posting something about the job. He was being investigated by the department. And as part of the department's investigatory system, Cole submitted a written report about the investigation, about the allegations against him. He sent a copy of it to the employer, but provided a copy to Local 825. Egan then reprimanded Cole for providing a copy to the local, and the local filed an unfair labor practice complaint with Connecticut's State Board of Labor Relations, saying Weingarten violation. This report, said the local, this report is the equivalent of questioning under Weingarten, and the union has a right to copies of those materials. And the board, the Labor Relations Board, agreed with the union. And I'll just read you a couple of sentences out of the board's opinion that give you a flavor for this. Here's what the board said. Requiring submission of a written statement by an employee suspected of misconduct is fundamentally no different than a face-to-face investigatory interview. An employer should not be able to deny employees their Weingarten rights merely because it has chosen to require that they produce written statements instead of, or in addition to, submitting oral interviews. Now, the Labor Relations Board says, look, we admit the National Labor Relations Board hasn't addressed this issue, but a number of other state labor boards have. The Connecticut Board cites decisions out of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but there are decisions from other states across the country. And the Connecticut Board says they've all come out the same way. That written statements in an investigation of employee misconduct trigger Weingarten and require or allow an employee the ability to involve the union in the process. When I say there's some controversy over this, I say that because I've actually been lecturing on this issue sometimes, and I've seen the debate spring out amongst members at the seminar with one faction, think of them as the management side faction, saying, no, Weingarten's all about the face-to-face interaction and the fact that a union rep can get involved and help out the employee. And the union side faction saying, hey, it doesn't make any difference. If it's a statement and there's potential disciplinary implications to the statement, the union has a right to be involved in the process. And in fact, the union can help make that statement a better statement by being involved. So you see that debate, but I'll tell you where I don't see the debate is in state labor boards. They seem to think, very convincingly, they seem to think that the Weingarten rights apply to written statements. While I'm talking about employee rights issues, let's go on over to Michigan. Very brief opinion that came out from the Michigan Court of Appeals. What this opinion does is to tell people who are drafting statutes, like in particular public safety Bill of Rights provisions, that they need to be very careful in how they're drafting their statutes. Here's what's going on in the Michigan case. Michigan has a statute. It's called Section 15.395. I may not refer to the number again. Let's just call it the statute. And this is a statute that says that Garrity statements made by employees pursuant to an employer's orders are confidential communications. And Garrity statements, by that I mean statements that are compelled as part of an internal investigation. The sort of statement where the employer sits the employee down and says, you are compelled to answer our questions. If you do not do so, you're subject to discipline up to and including termination. Those are statements that are thought to be protected under the Supreme Court case of Garrity versus New Jersey. So we call them Garrity statements. This is an investigation. This case involves an investigation coming out of the city of Portage, which is a smaller city in Michigan, and it involved two officers, Douglas Lewis and James Myers, and they were both involved in internal affairs investigations, and they gave Garrity statements in the course of those investigations. Both of them were fired by the city, and when they were fired, The director of public safety, a fellow named Richard White, gave a press statement that commented on the terminations. Lewis and Meyer then sued. They said, look, Garrity's statements are confidential under the statute, and by commenting to the media about the reasons for our termination, you are breaching the confidentiality bestowed by the statute. The Michigan Court of Appeals says something pretty interesting. It starts off by saying, by faulting Lewis and Myers, it says, look, if you're going to claim that the director of public safety disclosed confidential Garrity statements, you've got to identify specifically what it is he disclosed, and you didn't do so in your lawsuit. So kind of a technical failure of proof in the case. But it's what the court goes on to say that's really important. And the court goes on to say, look, even if you had proved that the director released Garrity statements, you don't have a lawsuit. Why not? The statute very clearly says that these statements are confidential. Why don't you have a lawsuit against the director of public safety for breaching the statute? And the court says the statute doesn't create a cause of action and doesn't specify a remedy. And quoting from the court's decision, Michigan case law says no cause of action can be inferred against a governmental defendant. The court says, look, the officers make a facially appealing argument that it's unfair for the legislature to grant a right under the statute without providing an effective remedy to enforce the right. But the court goes on to say, not our business. That's the legislature's business. That's the matter of public policy. We understand the right of confidentiality, but if the legislature wants the court system to enforce this statute, it's got to create a cause of action in the statute, and it also has to provide a remedy. Now, that's principle. It's not the law everywhere. It's the law in many states. Some states would come out to the contrary and say, look, you can infer a cause of action or imply a cause of action through how you write a statute. But I do think, back to my original point, I do think there is a message in here for anybody who's involved in writing statutes, and that is think these things through before you put pen to paper, and make sure you do complete research to find out whether or not you're in a jurisdiction like Michigan where you'd better be spelling out the remedy that obtains from violation of a statutory scheme such as a public safety bill of rights. Continuing on our journey around the country this month, let's talk about post-retirement health insurance and a case that comes out of Nebraska. And whether or not there is any contractual or constitutional protection for post-retirement health insurance. And the answer, you'll see, is it depends. It depends how the post-retirement health insurance was created and what words were used, in fact, in the process of creating that benefit. All right, what's this case about? This case starts actually long, long ago, 1974, in Douglas County, Nebraska. And then the Board of Commissioners of Douglas County passed a resolution which allowed employees of the county who retired to participate in the county's health insurance plan between the ages of 55 and 65. The resolution didn't say anything about the premiums that would be charged or whether it would be the same or different as active employees. But since that time, since 1974, and in fact for more than 35 years, retired employees were required to pay the same premiums to participate in the plan as active employees. Every year, the Board of Commissioners would adopt an ordinance that would specify the benefit levels and the contribution levels, And every year that ordinance drew no distinction between active and retired employees, but rather it just merely referred to employees, the word employees, and was applied to everybody. Well, 2008 hits, the county starts seeing very serious fiscal problems, is trying to balance its budget, and one of the places it looks to balance its budget is to set a different contribution rate for retirees than active employees. So, for example, for retired employees who had employee-only coverage, they had to pay 25% of the total premium after 2008. Active employees only had to pay 7%. And a group of retirees sued the county saying, hey, look, we have protected post-retirement health insurance, protected by contract, and derivatively, it's protected by the Constitution. Post-retirement health insurance plans are like retirement plans. You can't unilaterally cut them. You've made a promise. We've lived up to our end of the promise, say the retirees. Now it's time for the county to live up its end of the promise. That's a case that goes through the Nebraska court system and ends up with the Nebraska Supreme Court, which unanimously rules against the retirees. What's the problem, the court says? What's the problem with that argument that the retirees are raising? The problem, the court says, is that retiree medical is a little bit different, and in this case, very different than a pension plan. For example, the employee's participation in post-retirement health insurance was purely voluntary, and obtaining coverage under this plan wasn't contingent upon rendering service, but rather all it did was require that you pay premiums. There's something different, the court says, that between a retirement plan and this sort of system. Here's the words from the court. A statute concerning employee benefit plans for a county requires only that the political subdivision may establish benefit plans for its employees, which will provide medical coverage. On the other hand, a retirement system shall be put into place by a county, and all permanent full-time employees shall begin participation in the retirement system upon employment. The court says this is very different. There's no promise here. You use the word may, and that vests discretion with the employer. The court says, concludes, this plan is not a pension, it's not a form of deferred compensation, and thus the retirees had no contractual right to participate in the plan for the same premiums as paid by active employees. And you know, that's the way these cases typically go. These cases meaning not just post-retirement health insurance cases, but also pension cases, as to whether there's contractual or constitutional protection for these sorts of benefits, is you will find courts drilling deep into the language of the plans to see whether or not there's an unconditional promise, an unconditional quid pro quo. You do this work, you put in this amount of time, you vest, and we will pay you post-retirement health insurance or a pension. If that unconditional promise is not there, you're going to see a result like the retirees in Douglas County, Nebraska saw. Let's travel south of the border of Nebraska to Kansas for a case about civil service systems. Over the course of the last 20 years, we've seen a lot of law enforcement and fire protection unions trying to substitute binding arbitration for civil service boards. There have been a lot of different reasons. There's kind of a distrust that unions have of the civil service system. Unions will point to the fact that civil service commissioners, board members, are typically appointed by the employer. They don't think that they can get a fair shake before a civil service board on an appeal of discipline. Unions will also point to the fact that civil service board members are typically citizen volunteers who don't have any labor relations background, something different from an arbitrator who will do disciplinary cases as part of his or her livelihood. Lots of reasons why unions have done that. And one of the reasons is that unions have perceived that there's not a meaningful appeal to a civil service board of discipline or out of a civil service board of discipline because of the standard of review. What degree of deference is going to be given to the decision maker? If you're in arbitration, the arbitrator is typically going to decide, is this disciplinary decision right or wrong? If you're in a civil service system, there may be a high level of deference given to the initial decision maker where basically the burden of proof, at least informally, transfers to the employee. Instead of the employer having to prove that its disciplinary decision was right, rather the employee in some civil service systems will be facing a very difficult burden of proof. Well, this case out of Kansas, it comes out of Johnson County, Kansas, is a real good illustration of this last reason why unions have been trying to replace civil service with arbitration. This involves he's called a master deputy. I haven't heard that rank used very often. Master Deputy Michael Maurer. And what he does is to crack a department vehicle's windshield with a binder while trying to shoo away a bothersome horsefly. He initially reported the incident by writing, and I'm quoting, "crack in windshield - rock" on a yellow sticky note and leaving it for his commanding officer, who's a sergeant. The next morning, he speaks with his sergeant and tells him that the crack on the windshield had spider-webbed as a result of a rock chip. Another deputy, though, actually saw the horsefly incident and turned Maurer in. And Maurer then writes a report and responds to questions and tells the truth. He's fired, nonetheless. And the sheriff, a fellow named Denning, takes the position that look, if he's untruthful at all, he should be terminated. End of issue. And Maurer appeals to the Civil Service Board, and the board reverses the termination. Writes a pretty lengthy award for a Civil Service Board, analyzes the evidence, and ends up deciding that there's not enough evidence to support termination and orders Maurer's reinstatement. The sheriff appeals. The court sends the case back to the board for further proceedings. The board then reverses itself, upholds the decision to terminate Maurer. Maurer appeals, and eventually the case lands before the the Kansas Supreme Court. Different result if it shows up before the California Supreme Court. So the case ends up in the Kansas Supreme Court. And the Kansas Supreme Court says, look, we've got to look at our civil service statutes, and we have to look at the standard of review that's buried in them. And what we find is that the statutes, the civil service laws, authorize the Civil Service Board to receive and consider evidence, both for and against a termination, and to determine the reasonableness of the termination decision, to approve or disapprove of that decision, and to make orders. So the court says, all right, so the standard here is that of reasonableness. And what does that mean? The court says a decision is reasonable if it is supported by substantial evidence. Substantial evidence is one of those terms of art in the law that actually, when you dig into it, means exactly the opposite of what it implies. You'd think substantial evidence would mean a lot of evidence. But substantial evidence really means any probative evidence. Even if the evidence is like 80% on one side and 20% on the other, and the decision maker goes with the 20%, well, that's going to be substantial evidence. So the court says that's the standard we're going to apply here. And in this case, the board, in overturning the termination, exceeded the scope of its authority. It failed to understand substantial evidence. It made factual findings, which are supported by the evidence, but it did not take into account that there was some other evidence, and it may have been the minority of the evidence that supported the sheriff, and therefore it should have upheld the termination. It doesn't matter what Maurer's work record was. It doesn't matter that his sergeant doesn't think he should have been fired and wanted him back. What matters, says the Kansas Supreme Court, is that the board exceeded its scope of authority by substituting its judgment rather than applying the requisite reasonableness standards. And reasonableness, the court says, is it had to decide whether the sheriff's decision was, and I'm quoting, itself unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious, and not supported by the uncontroverted facts of the case. All right. There's a dissenting judge. He says, look, the Civil Service Board concluded that Maurer's finding wasn't reasonable. We can't substitute our judgment for that. The judge is pretty pithy. He says, no matter how much the court tries to spin what it's doing, the bottom line is it's simply reversing a decision, Civil Service Board's reinstatement decision, that the court doesn't like. That's not our function, and I wouldn't do it. I would comment that this court's opinion from the standpoint of disciplinary appeals is it's just a holy mess. It's terrible. It demonstrates that the court doesn't understand what the word reasonable means. Reasonableness is, you know, right or wrong. Would a reasonable person have done this under the circumstances? It's not a substantial evidence test. And then when the court gets into substantial evidence and ends up equating the notion that in a substantial evidence standard of appeal is the same as abusive discretion, no, it's not. They're very, very different. But this is the final decision of the Kansas Supreme Court on a matter of state law, and state Supreme Courts have the right to make those final decisions. So there's no appeal into the federal court system. Maurer's through. He can't be a deputy anymore, whether this court's opinion is right or wrong. And the reason I cite this case is not because it's a model of legal analysis, as I indicate to you. I have my doubts on that front. But rather, it demonstrates one of these three reasons, as I mentioned, why unions are trying to get away from civil service systems and trying to get into binding arbitration. Don't want to face decisions like that. Now let's go to California. And let's go to LAPD and kind of a rarity in public safety labor relations, which is a Fair Labor Standards Act retaliation lawsuit. The FLSA has some pretty broad anti-retaliation provisions in it. Basically, you can't, if you're an employer, you can't retaliate, can't discriminate against an employee who is engaged in think of it broadly as protected activity under the FLSA. What does that mean? It could mean filing a lawsuit. That certainly is protected activity. But it could also mean testifying in somebody else's FLSA lawsuit. Or it could mean assisting an employee who's bringing an FLSA lawsuit. Those are all types of protected activities that are covered by the FLSA's anti-retaliation claims. Well, this is a case that involves a LAPD officer. His name is Leonard Avila. Avila testifies in one of a series of FLSA cases brought against LAPD seeking compensation either for donning or doffing, or in this case, at least in part, for another employee who alleged that there's a pattern and practice of LAPD of having officers work through their meal periods without compensation. Avila is a witness. He's subpoenaed. He comes in and testifies. Yep, I work through my meal periods. I've seen a lot of other employees work through their meal periods. I've seen my supervisors work through their meal periods. In my opinion, there's an unwritten policy of not claiming overtime for working through lunch. Right after he testifies, LAPD launches an internal investigation against Avila and another officer who testified the same way in the case. They were ordered to appear before kind of the internal disciplinary board in Los Angeles. It's called the Board of Rights. It's a disciplinary review body. Avila ends up resigning during the course of the hearing in a lunch break. He announces, okay, got a job with another law enforcement agency. I'm out of here. The board doesn't accept the resignation. It nonetheless proceeded against Avila in absentia. He left. He went to his new job. So the board proceeds against him. They find him guilty of insubordination. What's the insubordination? That he disobeyed department rules by working through his meal period without submitting an overtime request. They find him guilty of insubordination, and they fire him. Avila then sues the city, saying, hey, you illegally retaliated against me because of my testimony. And a jury finds in favor of Avila on the retaliation claim, awards him damages of $50,000. Kind of a strange sort of award there, $50,000. It's a very round number for an FLSA case. Avila looks like he went and, you know, got the other job, so it's not likely that's back wages. But nonetheless, awarded him $50,000. A judge then awards him an additional $50,000 in liquidated damages. Remember, the FLSA is almost always a double damages statute. And then the big part of the award was attorney's fees. What attorney's fees can you get? $579,400. So attorney's fees that are 10 times the amount of the damages awarded by the jury, five times once you include the liquidated damages. The city appeals to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, appeals the jury's verdict, and really has one argument before the Court of Appeals. It makes, you know, like most people who are appealing cases, they make a number of arguments, but it really has one important argument, and that is that, look, the Board of Rights recommendation that Avila be terminated for insubordination precludes his retaliation claim. In other words, Avila had the right to litigate this whole issue before the Board of Rights. And if you have a right to litigate something in one forum, you can't go to another forum, in this case federal court, and relitigate the same matter. You lose in one forum, you're stuck in another. There's lots of phrases that are that the law gives to that. Sometimes you hear the phrase res judicata, sometimes collateral estoppel, sometimes the newer terms, issue preclusion or claim preclusion. But the whole notion is, if you fight it out in one forum, you're not going to get a second bite at the apple somewhere else. That's what the city's argument is. Says, look, the Board of Rights decision should have preclusive effect. And the Ninth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, says, nope, that's wrong in this case. Because, the court says, the real question is whether the board decided that Avila was fired in retaliation for testifying in the FLSA case. The court says, look, neither the board decision nor the termination order even addressed the issue of retaliation. The administrative proceedings just found Avila guilty of the insubordination count. Therefore, since neither the Board of Rights nor the city determined the motive for the disciplinary action, what happened before the Board of Rights doesn't prevent Avila from bringing a lawsuit. The city makes a second argument, which is to say, look, we would have fired him anyway. We would have said, you know, he was insubordinate. Our rules allow termination for insubordination. We would have fired him even without regard to his testimony. And then the court says, look, to the extent, this is a quote, to the extent that the city is urging it would have reached the same decision on terminating Avila in the absence of his testimony, well, there's no evidence about that. The city's own witnesses made plain that only those who testified in the FLSA lawsuits were disciplined for failing to put in overtime requests. It can't be argued that Avila would have been fired had he not testified. Think of this case kind of as a note to employers that if you're upset about an employee who has somehow participated in an FLSA case, whether or not they've brought the action or they've testified in it, take a deep breath, wait a while, and then talk to your lawyers, and then think about whether you should proceed against them in a disciplinary way. The FLSA's retaliation provisions are pretty strict. I will tell you that I've had a few cases, a few FLSA cases, where I've heard from my clients that employers have threatened retaliation. Many times they seem to come out of claims for off-duty canine compensation, canine care compensation, where an employer will threaten to eliminate the canine program or something like that. I once had a case. It involved about 10 canine officers. I won't identify the county, but I will say it's in California. Once had a case where the sheriff, in the course of mediation, we bring in a mediator through the federal court lawsuit that we have here. In the course of the mediation, the sheriff apparently tells the mediator that if she has to pay out any damages as a result of this lawsuit, the result is going to be a barbecue in the parking lot of the sheriff's office where the canine program dogs will be the main course. She's going to barbecue the dogs. That's you know, kind of an absurd threat of retaliation. But you see these pop up from time to time. It's deep breath time for employers in these FLSA cases. I get that they're not fun. I get that sometimes you'll feel kind of personally wounded by the employee, but be practical about it, because the FLSA implications can be serious. Here, you're looking at the city of Los Angeles paying almost $700,000 as a result of retaliation. I want to wind up this podcast by heading down to Florida. I mean, what would a podcast be without a Florida case, right? They provide some of the most interesting facts, and they sure do come up very often. This is one that involves a corrections probation supervisor who works for the Department of Corrections. And this one is important because it tells us how important the employee's state of mind is in a disciplinary case. This supervisor, her name was Andrea Allen. She was working as an office manager for Department of Corrections. She had 27 years of service. And she makes the decision that she supervises a number of COs. She makes the decision that she wants to develop better relationships with them and become even a more valuable employee. And what better way to do that than to buy a gun? And that's what she does. Her husband goes out and purchases a Glock 9mm for her at Walmart. He also buys her a gun belt and assorted other shooting paraphernalia. One of her subordinates buys her ammunition, and she puts all this stuff into a large Walmart plastic bag, or actually a couple of bags, and places them all in the back seat of her vehicle. Her husband drives her to work, what her intent is, she's going to take this stuff after work. She's going to go to the shooting range and practice. So it was raining very hard that morning when her husband drove her to work. She was in a passenger seat, and the bags with all the shooting gear fell off the back seat. The husband stuffed everything back into the Walmart bags and inadvertently included a box containing the gun itself. Allen had planned to leave the gun in the car because she knew she couldn't bring it to work. The Department of Corrections has very strict standards about employees not bringing guns to work unless they're specifically authorized. She knew those rules. She didn't know that her husband had put the gun into the bags. What she does is she grabs all the bags and then puts them in her office on a chair. An officer that she supervises comes into her office during the course of the day, looks at the bags and thinks, hey, there's something suspicious in there. So what this officer does is he waits until he is sure that Allen is not in her office, and then he goes and looks in the bags. There's got to be a backstory behind this, right? At any rate, he looks in the bags, sees the gun box, immediately reports Allen to her supervisor. The department starts an investigation and fires Allen. Her labor organization, which I believe is the Teamsters, if I recall correctly, appeals the termination to arbitration. And the arbitrator talks at great length. He's a very famous arbitrator, by the way. His name is Roger Abrams, widely viewed as one of the best arbitrators in the country, and been doing arbitration a long, long time. This arbitrator reverses the termination and orders Allen's reinstatement, but without back pay. Here's his rationale. He said, look, first of all, Allen made a very serious mistake. It's a mistake that in many cases would warrant termination. Arbitrators are real strict about employees bringing guns into the workplace. And so she's got to have serious discipline. On the other hand, says the arbitrator, we have to look at her intent. Did she intentionally do this? Did she want to bring this gun to work? No, in fact, she wanted the contrary, said the arbitrator. She had no idea that her husband had stuffed the gun into the Walmart bag. Let me give you a couple of sentences out of the arbitrator's opinion that give you a feel for how arbitrators look at this sort of thing. The arbitrator says, look, there's other significant factors in mitigation present here that need to be taken into account. Allen was a 27-year employee with only a few minor transgressions on her record that are outweighed by her splendid evaluations and the accommodations she received. Her misconduct that day was uncharacteristic, here it comes, the result of carelessness, not deliberate or conscious violations of the employer's code provisions. Here it comes again, her conduct was neither willful nor persistent, but purely inadvertent. So that's why the arbitrator reverses the termination. Why is it reinstatement without back pay? It's reinstatement without back pay, the arbitrator says, because she's a supervisor. She knew the rules. She trained on the rules. She was careless. She shouldn't have been. And it's very serious act of misconduct bringing a gun into the workplace. So therefore, reinstatement without back pay. I go over this case with you for two reasons. First, the reason that I stated. And that is the critical importance of employee intent in these termination cases. I sometimes like to think of these as a distinction between a mistake of the head, was this just simply negligence or carelessness, which is likely to be forgiven by an arbitrator, and a mistake of the heart, something like dishonesty, where an arbitrator just simply will say, this person just doesn't have the clay to be an employee. That issue of intent is so, so important in these cases. And in these types of cases, it's very important that the employee get on the witness stand, own up to what it is they have done, and have the arbitrator hear whether or not this employee really is a good person who made an honest mistake. The other reason I bring it up is what would be a podcast without a mini rant from me? I hate this result. Reinstatement without back pay. By the way, a lot of arbitrators will not award that result. Why? Because the penalty is not proportionate to the offense. Almost by definition, it's not, right? The penalty, I mean, how long did it take to get to arbitration here? 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? Arbitrator's opinion doesn't reflect that. 12 months, 15 months, whatever it might be. How is it possible that the length of time it takes two litigants, the union and the state, to get to arbitration, the length of time it takes to schedule an arbitrator's hearing, the length of time the hearing takes, and the amount of time it takes the arbitrator to write the opinion, how can that ever be the measure of proportionateness of a penalty? The penalty should be proportionate to the offense, not the schedules of the lawyers that are involved and how fast somebody gets to arbitration. I suggest to you this is a remedy that really doesn't make any sense from a just cause standpoint. Nonetheless, you know, I'm pretty convinced Alan's very happy she has her job, and I'm pretty convinced the Department of Corrections is pretty happy it doesn't have to make back payments to Alan. Nonetheless, this sort of decision kind of grates on me. Well, that's it for August and our first Thursday podcast. Hope to see you in Las Vegas in September for our grievance procedures seminar, where we go over what goes through the minds of arbitrators and the kind of the nuts and bolts and tear apart grievance procedures for you. We have a great seminar lineup. Go to our website, LRIS.com, where you can find out more information about that seminar. And as a reminder, we're bringing a seminar down to Florida in October. We're bringing our seminar on how to run a police and fire union. That's as a result of a lot of requests from people on the far side of the Rocky Mountains, at least from my perspective, that we bring seminars to the East Coast. So we're going to give it a shot in Florida. And in the meantime, enjoy the rest of the summer. Hope it's not too hot wherever you are. This is Will Aitchison signing off.